You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Master Wong, I have come to challenge you so that the people will know that my martial arts are the best.
This is Studio 360 from WNYC in New York and Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today, musicians try to out-rap and outdo each other.
KRS-One wears Nikes, Shannon, his crew wear Pumas. Even this becomes fodder for the battle.
And the heroes and villains of Hong Kong action films stake out their territory.
These people would be vying with each other to become famous in the world of swordplay.
My guest is the novelist and travel writer Paul Theroux.
Everyone, to a certain degree, must have this sense of competitiveness. You know, in a Darwinian sense, it's what made us who we are.
That's all ahead in Studio 360, where art and real life collide. When I was a kid, there were occasional one-man theatrical shows depicting great American men of the 19th and early 20th centuries. Abraham Lincoln live on stage, Mark Twain, of course, Teddy Roosevelt. Then, a few years ago, I noticed that this genre had both morphed and expanded. A different kind of celebrity had become fodder for celebrity impersonation in the theater. At that moment, the subjects of choice were gay men and the larger-than-life women gay men loved, Truman Capote and Oscar Wilde, Maria Callas and Diana Vreeland. Theater experts told me then that the fad had pretty much peaked. But those experts, I noticed the other day, were mistaken. There are currently a half dozen bio-dramas and bio-musicals running in New York. Most of them meta-entertainments about the lives of entertainers, performers playing other performers. There's Say Goodnight, Gracie, in which an actor impersonates the late George Burns. The title is a reference, of course, to his wife and comedy partner, Gracie Allen, who died rather young in 1964.
She said she put salt in the pepper shaker and pepper in the salt shaker, so if she made a mistake, she'd be right.
There's Tea at Five, in which an actress impersonates Katharine Hepburn and reminisces about her beloved Spencer Tracy, who died in 1967. There's Lost Highway, about the life and music of the country and western singer Hank Williams, who died tragically young in 1953. There's the Jackie Wilson story about the life and music of the R&B singer, who died poor and tragically young in 1984. And there's Dream a Little Dream, about the life and music of the folk rock band The Mamas and the Papas, including Mama Cass Elliott, who died tragically young in 1972. So why all this biographical theater? Musicians' lives in particular are appealing to producers because as subjects they make natural musicals, musicals in which breaking into song never seems bizarre. But the phenomenon generally is about cultural conservatism. Producers are drawn to this material because audiences are drawn to it. And audiences are drawn to it because it's all pre-digested, pre-marketed, safe. The characters and their stories are already established in people's minds, famous and familiar before the shows even open. People come to the theaters knowing pretty much exactly what to expect, which is slightly depressing. Because aren't our most thrilling and memorable moments in theaters when we're surprised, amazed, even shocked by something altogether fresh? Some of these shows are good pieces of work, but there are so few slots for new plays and musicals in the big-time theater these days, it seems like the culture is punting when so many of those slots are occupied by shows about people and stories we already know. This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. It's the same old story, same old song and dance, my friend.
It's the same old story, same old song and dance. As the operations in Iraq shift from battle into the complications of peacekeeping,
reflecting on the war and what it means is a tricky business. Art may seem like a strange mission for the Defense Department, but in fact, every branch of the U.S. military sends trained artists into combat to document the experience. Studio 360's Michelle Siegel talked to two American combat artists about how they create the art of war.
It's natural to have a kind of healthy skepticism about military art. Art history is filled with images of brutal violence, romanticized victors, and their spoils of war. The Romans were pros at this. Think of Trajan's Column, 100 feet of marble friezes depicting the Roman emperor's exploits. A new book traces an American thread of military art. It's called The Art of War, Eyewitness U.S. Combat Art from the Revolution through the 20th Century. It includes Civil War scenes from Frederick Remington and Winslow Homer, and on-the-spot sketches and watercolors by official combat artists mobilized with active units in Somalia, Bosnia, and Afghanistan.
I very much feel that I was following in some pretty big footsteps.
Michael Fay is a staff sergeant in the U.S. Marine Corps Reserves, and in January of 2002, he was the first combat artist to be sent to Afghanistan. He is intensely aware of the art's significance to the Marine Corps.
One of the first things the Marines at Kabul did when we went at the American Embassy, they went and dug out all the Marine Corps art that was framed. And it was still, you know, apparently there were a couple of Afghan employees of the State Department who stayed there after we left, and they kept the embassy from really being ransacked. It was unusual. And the Marines that were there went and got all this artwork, put it up on the walls.
Field commanders praise the morale value combat art has for their ranks. Everything created by a combat artist becomes property of the U.S. government and eventually part of the extensive collections kept by the military's various museums and historical societies. With that in mind, a 1990 Marine Corps memo warns, "Do not create heroic, imaginary, or corny hand-to-hand stuff that would not be believable. Temper the blood and guts with a balance." Avery Chenoweth is the author of The Art of War. He began his 40-year career as a combat artist in Korea.
Well, I'll tell you, I had some writing paper, and whenever I could, and we were in a situation where the bullets weren't flying, I would make some sketches.
Chenoweth was called out of retirement to go to Kuwait in 1991, and his painting from the last day of Desert Storm is startling.
It was like moon glow, but it was red glow. And in the distance, every oil well head in Kuwait had been torched by the Iraqi. And it was just like the end of the world. And to make matters worse, right in the middle of that, every artillery piece in the Marine Corps sector of the 1st Division was firing at the same time on the same target. It was indescribable. So my painting is maybe exaggerated a bit in color, but it captures the essence that photographs didn't.
Photos do, however, play a part in the art-making process. The artists don't have time or resources to physically paint during operations. So they take photographs and make sketches that serve as guides for paintings they execute later. It can be difficult watching the carnage of war, and sometimes a combat artist can feel conflicted about military action being taken. Ultimately, what gives combat art its peculiar gravity is the unnerving perspective. It's made by someone engaged in war, someone trained to fight.
You know, it's like a football team. You know, I may know how to play football, but I don't know their plays. You know, so I don't want to get in the way. You know, these guys have done a lot more live fire exercise than I have. And, you know, it's incumbent on me to just sort of keep my head down. You know, if they need me, they'll tell me.
We went into combat armed, and as every Marine is trained, whether he's a cook, baker, aviator, artist, whatever, we are riflemen first. If push comes to shove, you will fight. You will not cower behind your sketch pad.
For Studio 360, I'm Michelle Siegel.
You can see some combat art on our website at studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and it is time for this week's cover story on Rivals.
Anything you can do, I can do better. I can do anything better than you.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
It's appealing to think of great artists as having great rivalries. A current show at the Museum of Modern Art in New York frames Matisse and Picasso as lifelong friends and ferocious competitors. We're invited to see these heroes of 20th century art goading each other, spying and stealing ideas, and also leading each other on to magnificent new heights in their work. We do love the idea that two creative geniuses might be jealous of each other's talent. Any truth to it brings them down to earth and makes them more like the rest of us, just as we love it when the gods in the Greek pantheon behave in mortal, ungodlike ways. My guest is the writer Paul Theroux. He has written 24 novels, as well as more than a dozen travel books drawn from his journeys in Asia, the Mediterranean, and South America. And his latest book is called Dark Star Safari, Overland from Cairo to Cape Town. Paul Theroux, welcome to Studio 360.
It's great to be here, Kurt.
Tell me about Dark Star Safari and why this particular trip at this particular time compelled you.
I had been trying to psych myself up for this trip back to Africa. I went to Africa in 1963 as a Peace Corps volunteer at a time when countries were just being given their independence, or they had struggled to get their independence. So 63 was a long time ago. People were saying in 5 years, 5 to 10 years, this place is going to be on its feet. Everything's going to be great. We're training teachers. They're getting money. Oxfam, Save the Children, all of them were, you know, digging in and doing stuff. And it's just a way of seeing what happened, like that tree you planted a long time ago in front of your house, a little sapling. Did it grow? Did someone kick it over? You know, is it bearing fruit? So it was that kind of part of it, memory lane, and part of it were places that I had never been before. And to go, I thought, back to my school, leaving from Cairo, going through Africa, seeing the school, and then continuing to Cape Town, overland.
And the sapling doesn't look too fruitful or healthy.
No, it's pretty. It didn't grow. It didn't. Something happened. It wasn't watered. Someone stole the fruit. All sorts of things happened. I mean, I must say my trip was joyous. I loved the trip. I loved going to the Sudan and Ethiopia. But I discovered things hadn't really turned out that well in places that I knew, in places that I could verify 40 years ago, it would look like this, and now it looks like something else.
When you were first in Africa 40 years ago, and one of the reasons we thought of you for this show is your friendship with V.S. Naipaul, whom you met in Africa,
and
a relationship about which you wrote a book, and a relationship that was characterized by some readers and reviewers as a rivalrous one. Do you feel as though it was or it is?
No. It wasn't rivalrous at all. It's kind of I mention him in this book too. In Dark Star Safari, I talk about him because I remember where I met him and how he behaved and what an interesting guy he seemed to me at the time. He was 34 years old, but he seemed much older. I was 22. A difference in ages meant that it couldn't possibly be a rivalry. It was a master-servant relationship or a teacher-student relationship. It was a mentor, whatever. He was teaching me things, showing me things. And it was very good for me. I mean, he taught me things that I'll always remember. He said famously, I have no masters. I have no rivals. I have no competitors. I have no boss. I owe nothing to anyone. I am just myself. And he said that that's what a writer must be. A writer must have no rivals.
Is it not possible, though, or does it seem entirely untrue that, yes, you were this young man looking up to this master when you were 22 and he was 34, but by the time you wrote this book and you were whatever you were, 40-something or 50 perhaps, do you not see that that's possible, that this once, you know, obedient, subordinate relationship blossomed into some kind of a rivalrous, envious feeling or not?
At a certain point, yes, I think it was a rivalry, not in my eyes, perhaps in his, because he felt underrewarded. His mantra was, I want $1 million. It was £1 million. I've got to have £1 million. If I have £1 million, I'll be all right. When my books began making movies, he said, you got $1 million for that, didn't you? I said, no, I didn't get anything like $1 million. And I could see that he really wanted – he's a very, very insecure person, and he felt that he security came from money. Of course, we know that security doesn't come from money. Although he got his million. I mean, when I was in South Africa, I saw a headline, pessimistic globetrotter wins Nobel Prize, and I thought I had got it, and he got it.
Well, there you go. You're rivalrous pessimistic globetrotters.
That's right. That's right. Who's the most pessimistic? But I think actually he felt he was my rival, but I didn't think that I was his at all. And sometimes rivalries can be one-sided. He didn't like to hear any. I once said to him, you know, I was reading George Orwell's essays, and I said, you have the same qualities as Orwell. And he said, I don't think Orwell is much of a writer, do you? And I said, well, yes, you know, I was reading Shooting an Elephant, and I said, yeah, it's a great essay. He said, well, he's overrated, don't you think? And I thought, well, that's interesting. He never wanted to hear, if you asked Naipaul who he liked, he would say nobody, no living writer, and only a few dead ones. I'd say Henry James, he said he overwrites. I'd say Orwell, he's overrated. You say Dickens, he overwrites. You'd mention anyone, D.H. Lawrence, Thackeray, Melville, Emily Dickinson. I've recited an Emily Dickinson poem to him, and he said, it sounds like twaddle. And so that kind of judgment makes you think he's competing.
And once you wrote this,
made me think that anyway.
Once you wrote your book about him and your relationship with him, did that sort of exercise whatever feelings you had about that relationship and whatever rivalrous feelings he felt or non-rivalrous feelings?
Yes, yeah, definitely exercise. When a friendship ends, it is dead as a doornail, and is a great subject. And there are not many books about friendship, or a great friendship, because you can only write about it when it ends. Then you have a perspective on it. I didn't dislike Naipaul at the end, but I thought I can't trust him, and I suppose he felt the same thing. Something had ended, and it ends forever. So it's writing the book, it exercised something, but it also reminded me of all the things that I hadn't written about. The idea of writing about a friendship is very threatening to people. And so my reviews were terrible, but because people saying, well, if he's doing that to his friend, you know, what would he do to me? What kind of a person is he? But it wasn't a getting even book. It wasn't saying what an awful person Naipaul was. It was how wonderful it is to know someone like that over 30 years and become a writer and learn so much. And what an odd fit. I remember Philip Roth read it, and he said, he's a great character. I couldn't invent the things, you know, the things that he says and the things that he does are just so strange. He's a character. You've got to write about him as an odd fish. Well, so there it is. But I didn't feel that it was a rivalry.
The writer Paul Theroux is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson. In a minute, we'll hear how Renaissance artists tried to one-up each other. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International.
Studio 360 is supported in part by Nonesuch Records, now featuring Mambo Sinuendo, a 50s-style album of Cuban mambo jazz by guitarists Ry Cooter and Manuel Galban, available at tower.com/nonesuch.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. My guest today is the writer Paul Theroux, and we're talking about rivalry. Rivals have been around as long as people have envied each other's success, which is to say forever. Sarah Fishko found some places where rivalry is productive and where it isn't.
Once you start to look for it, rivalry is everywhere in art, in every culture, in every artistic discipline to one degree or another. The two leading opera stars in London in the 1720s were Francesca Cuzzoni and Faustina Bordoni. They were known to be rivals, and in 1727 their rivalry escalated to an onstage fight. They scratched and kicked and pulled each other's hair, by all reports. They are satirized to great effect in The Beggar's Opera, produced the following year, 1728, in London. The main characters, Polly Peachum and Lucy Locket, having been based on the contentious pair, Cuzzoni and Bordoni. Why, ho, now, madam, flirt, if you thus In more recent times, Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra were said to have been at odds in the filming of the movie High Society. The screenwriter John Patrick had to prepare multiple versions of the screenplay, making it look to each star as if he had the bigger part.
We sing so rare. So rare.
The Impressionist painters were a rivalrous bunch, Renoir and Monet, for example, having painted side by side for a time, spurring each other on to more feathery brushstrokes, greater explorations of light. Jazz musicians in the 40s, Woody Herman and the like, had wildly rivalrous battles between bands and soloists. According to a new book, it is Italy in the 16th century that really has something to tell us about the whole subject of rivalry in art. In fact, the title of the book is Renaissance Rivals, Michelangelo, Leonardo, Raphael, Titian. The author is Rona Goffin.
I think the first thing to understand is that the Renaissance is a period that named itself, and the word means literally in French, though they, of course, used Italian, rebirth, rinascita. What was being reborn was classical antiquity. First in literature, then later on in the visual arts. And once you take the idea of emulation or imitation of a model as your starting point, I think it inevitable that you begin to think also in competitive terms. That is to say, if you're imitating a model, at the same time you're trying to surpass it. So I think the notions of imitation and rivalry are absolutely inextricable.
Of course, there were competitions in those days, the four artists battling it out for a commission, but that's not quite the same.
Rivalry, I was thinking of in more personal terms, as when Raphael and Michelangelo rival each other, painting literally within stone's throw of each other, for example, in the Vatican Palace, Michelangelo working on the Sistine ceiling, Raphael really next door painting in the Stanze della Signatura, both for the same patron, who, by the way, was known to walk back and forth between them. He had to go through those rooms to get from his bedroom to public chambers. Of course, there's personal rivalry.
To rival someone means to tangle with one's equal. One or more striving for a goal only one can attain. In this case, the goal of being the best.
You don't fence with someone who doesn't know which end of the épée to hold. These men knew what they were.
And they were using each other, you might say, to push the medium forward.
And the most stunning example is really Raphael, because Raphael started looking very much like his master Perugino, very sweet Madonna faces with small pursed lips. As soon as Raphael moved to Florence in 1504, when Leonardo was back in town and when Michelangelo was also in Florence, having just finished the David, as soon as Raphael moved there and saw what they had been doing, he immediately co-opted their ideas and went through a stunning transformation. This is not to say that he was a mere copycat, but he knew how to take from others and make it his own.
Michelangelo, when he sensed Raphael was starting to dominate, did what he did in any crisis or confrontation. He left town. And so it went.
Artists have always copied from each other since the dawn of time, or since the dawn of paint.
But this was the Renaissance.
In this rebirth, you don't want clones. You want better thans. Otherwise, you're just parroting the source. You must emulate and compete in order to do better than the source. And that's what they did.
If the Renaissance was a whole period jump-started by rivalry, there are whole cultures built around rivalry, as expressed in art. Dr. Kathy Curnow is an associate professor of African art history at Cleveland State University. She runs a seminar called Rivalry, Competition, Art, and Power. The focus is on southern Nigeria and especially Benin Kingdom, where rival chiefs compete for public attention.
There's a real pecking order. There are about 200-plus chiefs in Benin. So where you are within that hierarchy really matters.
In her class, Curnow points out the ways rivalry is encouraged in the culture. The king, for example, gives privileges to some chiefs and not to others, leaving the chiefs to try to figure out why and to try to find ways to increase their popularity.
To be a chief in Benin is to be an actor on the social stage, and everything you do in public is gauged and calculated. And that idea of popularity is really important, and art reinforces it. And they use everything at their disposal. costume, architecture, the kind of house you build, the kind of furniture you have.
This is a society in which rivalry itself is considered an art form.
It is also a spectator sport, because people watch these maneuvers with great interest and talk about them in detail. It's strategized about. People try to plan in terms of what they see other chiefs doing. One-upmanship never ends. No one's ever in a stable position as far as their popularity is concerned. It's always shifting.
Curnow tells a famous story about the rivalrous culture.
There was a wedding back in the 80s in Lagos between two very extremely wealthy families. Each family hired a very popular band. What they did, they closed off the street for the wedding. They had one band posted at one end, the other at the opposite end. And they played at the same time. The guests loved it, and it's still being talked about 20 years later. As they say in Benin, it's your enemy that makes you.
A new, or in fact very old, way to measure one's place in the world.
Because only a person that's insignificant won't have enemies.
For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Fishko.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today, talking with the writer Paul Theroux about rivals and rivalry. Paul, I don't know about you. I could listen all day to stories about Michelangelo and Leonardo being rivalrous in petty ways. I guess in that sense that I said at the beginning that one likes to think of great geniuses as being subject to the same sinful pettiness that the rest of us are.
Yes. Well, actually, a name that wasn't mentioned in that little discussion is Cellini, Benvenuto Cellini, who I'm sure Renaissance rivals I have not read, but anyone would do well to read the autobiography of Benvenuto Cellini, who was a friend of all of them. I think actually friendship is a greater element in rivalry than enemy. I mean, I don't think we're talking necessarily about an enemy. Enemy is someone that you have no regard for, no respect for. But a rival isn't necessarily an enemy. A rival is more likely to be a friend. And that little Renaissance group, I think, that in Cellini's autobiography is that they were competing for attention. They're competing for boys. I mean, they were chasing boys around too.
Well, it is interesting, as you say, that it is when there's a mutual respect and even friendship is when and the differences in the sense of competition. Because it's over kind of nuance of success or achievement can become all the more ferocious.
Sure, and the another element I suppose is proximity. There can't be a rival if it over a long distance. I like the competing bands at the ends of the different ends of the street in Benin. The carnival has this element of proximity and you know the band, competing bands and the sound too.
As you've traveled everywhere in the world these last 40 years, do you have a sense that rivalry and that kind of status competition among equals is greater in America than elsewhere, or are there any cross-cultural differences regarding that?
I don't think it's greater in America. I think we mythologize it more. The mythology of, say, Avis and Hertz or Coke and Pepsi, it's kind of, although everyone's looking for an advantage. In business, what appears to be like a friendly rivalry is always sometimes pretty bitter, mean, and there's a lot of insider trading. So the mythology of the productive rivalry is that's one of our myths or one of our cherished story of national stories of how we're rivals and we all, kiss and hug at the end of it, and you're a winner. But winning really is everything here. I think it's a very old story. I mean, in Africa, for example, the mention of the chiefs in Benin is only one story of the chiefs being rivals. But of course, that's maybe within the same tribe. In Benin or in the same place. But think of Rwanda, for example, where you have the Bahutu and the Watutsi killing each other. I mean, a million people were killed in 1994. That was a rivalry that ended in massacre. There's the Ulster. There's Catholics and Protestants there, which is definitely a rivalry. not portrayed as such. That's it's romanticized a bit. It's wicked stuff of innocent people, you know, people blown up, women, children, you know, tourists in London, horses, all the rest of it. And that's in the past 25 years, or well, since 71 when there was Bloody Sunday. That's a rivalry. There's also what Freud, I mean, this is a lovely phrase in Civilization and Discontents, where he describes the narcissism of minor differences, which explains almost any national nastiness between, say, the French and the English, or Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland, or any people within proximity.
Canadians and Americans.
Absolutely, yeah. But and we're looking at minor differences. I mean, people say, well, Canadians pronounce their vowels strangely, or, you know, they wear funny hats or hairy jackets, or, you know, they get these plaids, or they, I don't know, funny names, whatever it is, it of religion. But it's my differences are mean something, and yours are, you know, junk. And so the narcissism of minor differences explains the source of a lot of competition, a lot of rivalries, and of people who ultimately become enemies. The big question is, at what point, I suppose, does a rival want to destroy the other person or the other? Or is it a race that we all run in which one wins and the others come second, third, and fourth? Or is it a war in which I destroy you and eliminate you from competition? That's probably the a distinction that removes it from, you know, rivalry from warfare, because obviously a rivalry can be healthy, but war is destructive.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 with the novelist Paul Theroux, and we are talking about rivals. Part of the fun of the movie 8 Mile, starring Eminem, was watching him and his rival rapper battle it out, improvising insults for the thrill and approval of the crowd.
With words that could put a hex on you, snap that neck on you, and keep a white boy or two. Let my man grab the mic. You see how Bunny Rabbit do. Come on, man.
Your style is generic. Mine's authentic made. I roll like a renegade.
Hip-hop has always depended on rappers being paired off like this. Three writers who watch hip-hop now tell us how it works. William Eric Perkins in Philadelphia, Trisha Rose in Santa Cruz, and Adam Monsbach in Berkeley.
This is Marley Marl featuring Craig G, one of his Juice Crew MCs, and it's a song which is about Red Alert.
I don't even remember how this happened.
This is a way of neutralizing physical violence in the black community.
The battles could be about anything. It's the symbolism of a struggle over supremacy.
Now, the song is called Duck Alert. A duck is like an expression at the time for a sucker, basically. You know, it's not like, hey, Red Alert, you suck. It's a little more subtle.
If I had to situate the sort of art of the battle in hip-hop historically, I would root it primarily in the history of verbal wordplay and battles in African-American culture.
Well, there's this long tradition in lower-class urban black communities, and it's what we call signifying, playing the dozens.
Toasting.
And, you know, your mama don't wear no drawers. I saw them when she take them off, you know. She hung them on the line, the sun refused to shine, that kind of thing.
That's really the primary oral tradition out of which hip-hop battles emerge.
They would battle each other in their rhymes, and what you have to do, we call that, you have to undress a cat.
That happened in hip-hop all over the place. It happened in early hip-hop on the streets. There were MC battles and in block parties. Then they became more organized MC battles where people compete to win the crowd over.
You know, one comes up and another comes up. And then you'd have the audience will go wild, and basically that would be how they would judge who was the winner.
As hip-hop moves from sort of a localized art form to something that's commodified and mediated and moves through the markets, a lot of these battles change and they're not local anymore.
Now you have them where they do it on recordings.
One of the seminal battles on wax, probably to a lot of old school fans the greatest one, would be MC Shan and the Juice Crew from Queensbridge versus KRS-One and his crew Boogie Down Productions from the Bronx, circa like 1987. This is The Bridge Is Over by Boogie Down Productions, which was KRS-One's group. It's a response to MC Shan and the Juice Crew's assertion that hip-hop started in Queensbridge. He did a song called The Bridge. This is The Bridge Is Over. This is KRS-One basically laying it down for the Bronx. The bridge is over. Manhattan keeps on making it. Brooklyn keeps on taking it. Bronx keeps creating it. And Queens keeps on faking it. So there it is right there. I mean, in that verse, Queens is faking it, the Bronx created it, and he goes on throughout the rest of this song to cast aspersions on MC Shan and his whole family, and even the sneakers he wears, you know. KRS-One wears Nikes, Shan and his crew wear Pumas. So even this becomes fodder for the battle.
Jay-Z, what's up, niggas?
The most recent battle of note in hip-hop, and the most high-profile one for a long time, a great many years, involves Jay-Z and Nas.
Hey, yo, I know you ain't talking about me, dog. You? What? Jay-Z.
Put your soul like ether. This is Ether, which is Nas's song about Jay-Z. For the main event, y'all impatiently waiting. It's like an AIDS test. What's the results? Not positive. Who's the best? Pop, Nas, and Big. Ain't no best. There's so much going on in that verse. You know, he points to the fact that everybody is into this battle. He says everybody's waiting patiently for the results like an AIDS test. What's the result? Not positive. Who's the best? Pac, Nas, or Big? Basically, he's saying, look, here's the canon, and Jay-Z's not in it.
It's like reading Homer. I'm telling you. You know, this is some it's heavy stuff. I have to sit here and, you know, turn it off, listen at a verse, turn it off, listen at it.
Nas sort of throws a barrage of different arguments. Jay-Z's thing, I'm sort of revealing my bias here, but Jay-Z's thing is much more of a sort of,
you know, I'm biased,
coherent critique of Nas.
Jay-Z is overrated, monotonic.
You know, it's not,
canned.
It's not a grab bag.
And this new album, I've been listening to it intensely. You ain't live it, you witnessed it from your folks'
pad. You scribbled in your notepad and created your life. So it's a critique of Nas's, you know, realness and his validity as a rapper. And I heard your album about your tech on the dresser. So yeah, I sampled your voice. You was using it wrong. You made it a hot line. I made it a hot song. Cats on street corners from Brooklyn to Oakland were reciting Nas's verse on one song, Jay-Z's on the other, comparing them, deciding who would hit who harder and better.
You know, this was last year, this was the biggest hip-hop thing, and they was afraid it was going to come to mad beef, as we call it.
It was too aggressive, and people were kind of taken aback. They were like, whoa, like, some of the stuff you said on this record is not cool. I mean, this is real cultural discourse at its best in some ways. It's people drawing on texts, critiquing them, analyzing them for things like content, flow, wit, bravado, and really drawing interesting conclusions. And to me, that's what battles can do. They can take this energy and disseminate it and make people think critically, you know, and I think that's really a good thing.
William Eric Perkins is the editor of Droppin' Science, a collection of critical essays on hip-hop music. Trisha Rose is the editor of a book about hip-hop culture called Black Noise. And Adam Mansbach is a novelist and poet. Jonathan Mitchell produced our story. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with the writer Paul Theroux. We're talking about rivals. I guess you and Naipaul just should have, you know, done rap songs about each other is probably how you should have handled that, I guess.
I don't think that Naipaul is and I would have got anywhere. We're too self-conscious, I think, to have been rapping at each other, although Naipaul was always very interested in the calypsos and how, you know, what the rappers are doing or what the calypsonians were doing all the time. I mean, in the 30s and the 40s, when Naipaul was growing up, there was a guy called Mighty Sparrow, who engaged in tremendous verbal abuse with each other. You know, get your sister down here, your mother, just the same thing that they're talking about. Those gentlemen talking about with the rap groups, the calypso bands competed in the same way. And I suppose in music, there's all, you know, the vying for supremacy, music, one instrument against another, area of rivalry that you could productively explore.
Paul Theroux is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson, and we are talking about rivalry. And in a moment, we'll hear about good and evil butting heads in Hong Kong action films. Stay with us in Studio 360
from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 with the novelist Paul Theroux, and we are talking about rivals. The best heroes and villains are sometimes reflections of each other. You think of Sherlock Holmes and Professor Moriarty, or even Luke versus Darth in the Star Wars epics. There's something of each in the other. Jocelyn Gonzalez has been watching this theme playing out for years in the martial arts and gangster films of China and Hong Kong. Besides helping American movies make action exciting again, Hong Kong cinema has brought competition and Eastern philosophy together.
When you redirect your opponent's energy, you force him to change. So in essence, he defeats himself.
All good films that talk about the nature of winning will virtually always say the same old cliche, which is you're not fighting anyone else, you're fighting yourself, as opposed to literally beating someone else.
Opposites are not always opposites. That opposites are also mirror images. Even in the symbol of the Tao itself, the yin-yang, complementarity and not pure opposition.
The origins of Hong Kong action cinema lie in the ornate tradition of Peking opera. When the Manchus began their conquest of China, they wanted to destroy the country's most powerful fighting force, so they outlawed the Buddhist Shaolin temples, where the monks had developed the lore and practice of martial arts. It's said that when the Southern Temple was burned down around 1760, a surviving monk taught kung fu to opera players to preserve the practice.
Chinese opera is a very, very unique art. It is part musical, part traditional drama, but it also involves wild gymnastics.
Jeff Yang writes about Asian culture and is the co-author of Jackie Chan's autobiography.
Meanwhile, a lot of the original actors who went into the Chinese cinema began in the Chinese opera. So they had that acrobatic training, the martial training. Many of them migrated into the place where there was most demand for their work, which was action film.
Chinese cinema had long thrived in Shanghai, a glamorous city whose highbrow citizens spoke mostly Mandarin. But in the 60s, the legendary Shaw brothers built a huge movie studio in working-class Hong Kong, whipping out nearly five films a week in Cantonese. The Shaws made movies that average blue-collar folks wanted to see. Sentimental dramas, sword fighting, and martial arts.
Things changed a little bit when rivalries began to develop. There was another film company called Cathay. It was founded by a guy named Dato Lok Wan, and he created a body of work through Cathay that was completely targeted towards a bit more of a bourgeois and elite constituency, so to speak. You know, the Shaw brothers and the Cathay organization ended up becoming this kind of ongoing running gunfight.
Jeff says the two studios battled for audiences, swiping each other's stars or copying each other's projects. But the Shaw brothers prevailed by dubbing their final movies into both Mandarin and Cantonese, thus making their movies accessible to nearly all of China.
And at that point, the Shaw brothers were essentially the undisputed kings of Asia's film industry.
Later on, new directors began to steer the cinema towards individual, conflicted heroes and their fighting skills. Hong Kong film expert Rick Myers calls these martial arts world films, stories that took place between warriors on an almost mythic plane.
If we had gunslingers, these were sword slingers. And there was spectacular movement and beautiful color. These movies were not only impressive cinematically, but they were insane in their approach, sometimes literally insane. At the end of Clans of Intrigue, a character rips off their own arm and uses it as a spear.
In the 70s, producer Raymond Chow left the Shaw Studio to start Golden Harvest Studios. Chow's own entry into the action arena? Bruce Lee. Bruce was cool, fluid, with an iron fist. After Lee's tragic death, the industry sought to duplicate his charisma and fighting style. But there were a lot of cheaper films, ones that were kind of looking for any excuse to throw the first punch.
What we've seen so far is, as Jackie Chan himself put it, why you look at me? Fight, 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 fight. In most of the kung fu movies we saw, it was really the cinema of vengeance. It wasn't the cinema of rivalry. In these wonderful Ma films, martial art world films, there was real rivalry in that these people would be vying with each other to become famous in the world of swordplay. So they would greet each other by saying, ah, are you not the man who killed 108 men last Tuesday? And it was like, yes, I am.
Master Wong, I have come to challenge you so that the people will know that my martial arts are the best.
Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon is a very good example in that Chow Yun-fat and Zhang Ziyi are really rivals, but they're not really enemies, although Zhang Ziyi seems to want to make Chow Yun-fat's character into an enemy. But the Cheng Pei-Pei character and Chow Yun-fat are clearly enemies.
And so you die.
And so shall you.
It's virtually a matter of how each character sees themselves and what each character wants to accomplish.
That is the kind of rivalry that you most frequently see, where you can see the human frailties and weaknesses within each, and also the human kindness, warmth, or mercy.
Rivalry is something that involves brains, while enemies is, you know, you're the bad guy, I'm the good guy, that's that.
Fine. Not friends, not sisters.
The, you know, idea of the warrior woman who kind of steps into armor and takes the field of battle is something that also comes from Chinese opera. There is kind of a more interesting rivalry there, which is that gender conflict, rivalry between the sexes.
When Hong Kong film began, film work was considered so lowly that men shouldn't do it. So we always had these great women actresses with mustaches. The problem was that once Hong Kong film was revolutionized with a film called One-Armed Swordsman, which turned it into all about machismo, it wasn't until much later in the 80s that Corey Yun Kwai did a movie called Yes, Madam, starring this newcomer Michelle Yeoh. Suddenly, studios and executives discovered, wow, when women do kung fu, they look really good.
We drew the photo!
Once they're allowed in the film, they are treated just the way men are, leading to some spectacular sequences of brutality. Here in America, we've never been without the gun. Our movies are not about excellence of self, they're about excellence of aim.
Like America, the Chinese are fascinated with modern-day cop shows and gangster films. In the 80s and 90s, director John Woo developed a cinematic style for his bullet-riddled crime stories. He combines the high emotion of opera with the gymnastics and camera work of martial arts cinema. But as his forebears had once extended a sword or a fist into the frame, he extends a gun. And rivalry for Wu is an expression of the Tao.
That cop and criminal, that hero and villain, are true kind of mirror images of one another, and it's obvious that with just a subtle shift, one could be the other. It really is kind of like a tango. And it all ends with this gothic operatic sequence in a hailstorm of gunfire. And then when they actually confront, they realize they have more in common than they are different. In that level, you know, rivalry isn't expressed as a shared almost love, a shared brotherhood that expresses itself in a finale in which the two die hand in hand or side by side.
For Studio 360, I'm Jocelyn Gonzalez.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. My guest today is the writer Paul Theroux, and our subject is rivalries. Paul, you lived for some time in Asia. Do those kinds of movies, which I think we in this country now regard as the great sort of pop cultural export of that part of the world, does that seem like a intuitively apt or correct expression of the culture as you know it?
I think that it's the fantasies of the culture of revenge, of flying, of whipping people's heads off, and that's where that the personal mythology is bound up with getting even. But you know, in fact, what you find is that people are very respectful to each other, and the most respectful people obviously have these fantasies of getting even. I thought quite a good point was made in the, when they talked about just the similarities of the rivals in these films. And I began to think that rivals have an element of like-mindedness. They have an element of respect versus contempt. You know, you don't have contempt for your rival. You have kind of respect for their for how they they're behaving, and you want to do it better. But you're very, very similar. You know, I began to think of the epic quest too of Ahab versus Moby Dick. Ahab wants to kill the whale, but actually the whale and Ahab are they're kind of cruising along this the Southern Ocean and, you know, trying to outwit each other. And vengeance isn't the same as rivalry, but you can see that there is an element of like-mindedness, the evil of Ahab, the evil of the white whale, and then and also the cleverness of it.
When you talk about the like-mindedness of rivals, and in that piece also they talked about how, you know, the rival is a reflection of yourself and you're battling your own demons or something. Is that inherent in rivalry, this sense that some battle against yourself or self-loathing, or is that a stretch?
I don't think it's a stretch, but I think it's how we want a rivalry to seem. I think that there's a certain conceit in rivalry that we want it to seem a little more elegant than it really is. You get that in Hemingway a lot, where you get the hunter really respecting the animal that he's hunting, and the battle of wills, like as though it's you know, it's an arm wrestling match where this, you know, in The Old Man and the Sea, that's what it's about, you know, the, fighting the fish and is he going to survive, and who, it's this seesawing that the, you don't know. There's even this line in Islands in the Stream where one of the kids says, when the fish was on the line or whatever it was, a shark or something, I didn't know which was him and which was me. Hemingway uses this, and that's to kind of dignify what is actually killing a fish or shooting blowing a buffalo's brains out. But I think Hemingway's pushing it there. I think that's how he wants it to be, because he's basically a conflicted, self-destructive individual who did shoot his brains out, and he's trying to somehow find a way of expressing that and to make it better than it is. Actually, it's a pathological condition. Basically, it's prettifying it.
Paul Theroux is my guest today in Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. You are a novelist. You've written 24 novels by my count. You've also written 14 or 15 books of nonfiction. Do you, as you go from one to the other, think of those as competing for your writerly attention?
No, not really competing for attention, although I know what you mean. I see that a novel only offers itself, you know, the subject of a novel only offers itself infrequently. To have a good idea is a rare thing, and as you get older, you have fewer and fewer of them. But a travel book, such as I write, is going and looking for it. My problem with the novel is that I hate being indoors. I always did. I mean, I lived for 17 years in England and hated it. I was just in a room. It was raining, and I couldn't wait to leave. And I wanted to go to Patagonia. I went to India. I went, you know, wherever I could go, the Pacific, just to get out of the house, because writing a novel keeps you in the house and keeps you indoors. It means that I was a pretty constant parent. I took my kids to school. They were there when they came home from school. There I was, still there, smoking a pipe and trying to write a sentence. So they got that lesson. But I don't think it's rivals for my attention. I just think that the novel is a very difficult thing that requires quite a lot of concentration and a lot of solitude, and that travel is not like that at all. I mean, travel is a different – it's liberating in the same way that fiction is, but it's you're outdoors doing it.
You have a very successful son who's a big television personality and humorist and journalist in England. Do you have any sense of rivalry with him, or with a child, is it all good?
Well, that's Louis, you know, who in his program Weird Weekends, prize-winning, you know, won two BAFTAs. There's Marcel, the oldest boy. He's written two novels. And one of the novels, the second novel, The Confessions of Mycroft Holmes, has an element of sibling rivalry in it. It's in the text, so they can write it. But your questions reminds me of something, a really interesting thing that happened to me when I was in London once, not that long ago. It was a couple of years ago, and I was buying something in a store. I was actually buying a print in a print shop. And the guy, when I wrote the check, the guy said, you're Louis's father. And I said, yeah. And he said, you're a writer. And I said, yeah. And he said, how does it feel to have a son that's more famous than you are? And I said, funny you should ask. I said, do you have any children? He said, yeah. And I said, what if your son had a print shop and he was making a ton of money? Would you be – how would you feel? He said, I'd be dead chuffed. I'd be chuffed. I'd be over the moon. I'd be cock-a-hoop. I said, oh, really, would you? Okay, well, then that's how I feel. I said, of course. I mean – it's a moot point whether Louis is more famous than me. Who knows? I mean, he's noticed. We go into restaurants. He gets the best table because they recognize him from television. And so I profit by that. I love it. When your child's successful, how can you possibly feel any sense of competition with the child? The child that you raised to be successful and happy and for the world to love him. You know, you want the world to see just how intelligent and nice and sensitive and creative and funny you found him growing up, and then everyone's telling you, God, he's funny, God, he's creative, God, he's successful. Louis is, you know, handsome, clever, and rich. What more could you want for a child? So I'm delighted. Definitely no sense of competition. I sometimes feel as if I should just take a long vacation and watch – I mean, I love watching Louis' shows and reading Marcel's novels and maybe just phase myself out and let them do it. You know, you take the trips, guys, and I'll stay home and play with my ducks and my geese.
So that, you know, they can take over the family
business.
It's just
a wonderful – yeah, take over the – absolutely, take over the family business.
Paul Theroux, thank you very much for joining me today in Studio 360.
Thank you, Kurt. It's been a pleasure.
Paul Theroux's new book is called Dark Star Safari, Overland from Cairo to Cape Town. If you'd like to find out more about him or about anything on this show, or if you'd like to listen to this show or any other Studio 360, you can do all of that on our website at studio360.org. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC along with PRI, Public Radio International. The production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Peter Clowney,
Michelle Siegel,
David Krasnow,
Lital Mulad,
Rob Weisberg,
Sarah Lilly,
Gardner Allen,
Andy Lancet.
The music is by David Van Tegum. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I do hope you'll join us next week here in Studio 360.
Studio 360 is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Additional support provided by None Such Records, now featuring Mambo Sinuendo, a 50s-style album of Cuban mambo jazz by guitarists Ry Cooter and Manuel Galban, available at tower.com/nonesuch.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, Lost Love and Trout.
The little quirky figure of... That signifies the trout quivering through the water, never swimming in a straight line.
We've gone fishing with Franz Schubert and the writer Ian Fraser next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.